So we're talking about funding and colonialism.
Yeah, and how I've, since I've started this job, I've been thinking about colonialism a lot, because I'm supposed to, the funder has told me that I can only provide services to these 600 individuals, these 240 families that live in this project. Mm-hmm. But in order for me to market programs to those people, I have to market it through relationships. And those 240 families have relationships outside of this housing project. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, maybe I have some resident who's, say, you know, 14 years old, and mm-hmm. he wants to come in and use the computers, but he has his cousin with him. Mm-hmm. And the cousin isn't a resident of this particular project. Mm-hmm. And so I say, well, you can come in, but your cousin can't come in. Well, I'm not coming in if I can't come in with my cousin. Mm-hmm. And so they both leave. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. where does that get me? And it makes me think of how the colonialists looked at a piece of geography. They drew these lines, straight lines that were perhaps made sense to the colonialists, but they mm-hmm. were dividing families and tribal groups, mm-hmm. which now, hundreds of years later, mm-hmm. are causing all these problems. I think what would make more sense is, instead of drawing these arbitrary lines of, well, you people live in this project and those people live in that project and we're going to have separate services, let's just think of them as a whole, mm-hmm. as a whole, mm-hmm. like social group, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, these weird, dividing them into these weird ways that don't make a lot of sense in the context of their lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this, like, these spheres of, you know, from my position, the colonialists would be like the grantors. Mm. And then the colonized would be the residents. Mm-hmm. And here I am going, I am trying to meet the needs of the residents. And I'm not really of the residents, but I can kind of get what works for them and what they need and what's relevant mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and what the barriers are for them. Mm-hmm. But then I can't have a conversation with the grantor, with the funder, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. they've got this huge bureaucracy. They don't want to know. They don't listen. They don't have even a mechanism for listening. If I phone them, they don't answer my phone calls, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when my one way of communicating with them is to write up an evaluation of what I'm finding. Uh-huh. They don't want to hear it unless it matches what I said when I asked for the money. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So there's no room for innovation. Yeah, there's no room for communication about these things. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, that is fascinating. For people in public housing, mm-hmm. do they get to pick where they want to live? They want to live near friends or families?
No. In fact, I can tell you a story if you want to hear it. Sure. Cut me off if you don't want to hear this story. But there is a woman who lives here, mm-hmm. who's a refugee, mm-hmm. and she is utterly by herself. There are no other refugee families uh-huh. in this housing project. Uh-huh. All the other refugees from her country that live in public housing are over across town in this mm-hmm. other project. Mm-hmm. And she came in the other day with her cousin, mm-hmm. and she said, Jennifer, they want to get housing. Can you help us get them housing? And their family is enormous. And there's only a handful of apartments that will accommodate a family mm-hmm. of that size. Mm-hmm. And there aren't any of those in this project. Uh-huh. They're only in the project across the way. Uh-huh. So what would be really good for this woman who lives here is to have her cousin and their family live near her so they can help each other. Uh-huh. But they can't, because there's no apartments large enough mm-hmm. to accommodate that family. Mm-hmm. And even if there were, they started saying, well, one of those people in that family is 18 years old. He could apply for his own apartment. Then they could fit into one of the apartments in this project. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. However, the waiting list is huge, so they won't get in for a couple of years anyway. Huh. And, well, by that time, this woman who already lives here, her needs might have changed considerably.
Yeah.
You know, maybe her kids will be old enough, they can help her more, mm-hmm. instead of her, you know, being so dependent on her, whatever. Yeah. So, how did I get on that?
Just that they can't choose where they go.
Not really. I mean, the pickier they are, mm-hmm. the longer they have to wait. Mm-hmm. There's quite a waiting list.
Well, it reminded me of when I was working in South Dakota on a reservation. And there were these, you know, they made the whole village tear down. The Army Corps of Engineers was going to build a new dam. And so the village, which had been for, you know, generations by the water, they made them move inland. And South Dakota's, you know, inland is kind of miles of nothing and just flat kind of barren, open to the sun, no trees or anything like that. Yeah. And so they built them these houses that look kind of nice. You know, they're vinyl siding and, you know, outside propane tanks, which, you know, is what's used out there. But people weren't taking care of them, and they're all looking junky, and, you know, a lot of them are vandalized. And so I'm asking people, you know, what's the deal with these? These look like decent houses. And they're like, well, yeah, but nobody wants to live where they're living. They have tribal connections and kinship bonds. That's what tribal life is all about, living on a reservation. And they're randomly slotted next to people sometimes that they've had generations of hostilities with.
Yes.
And so there's this sense of you know, this continued colonization.
Yes.
And these, of course, these Native Americans were originally from the East Coast. So they were people who learned how to live off of, you know, fishing and hunting like you do around New York State.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, in South Dakota, they're on this barren, desolate area. And it's called Crow Creek Reservation because the only way to survive the first winter was by throwing stones and killing crows and eating them as they came down to drink out of the creek. They were not used to living in that way. So there's this clear colonial connection there.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, the ethnic composition here is predominantly what is it?
Well, that's another huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are refugees from two different countries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small handful.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of people from the Dominican Republic and from Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And then African Americans, you know, who were born in Syracuse or in the United States somewhere.
Is that a large percentage?
Yeah, I think it's 60 or 70% are African American.
Mm-hmm.
It must be 60. 30%, and roughly 30% are of Hispanic origin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they might be African Hispanic,
right,
you know. And then they all have these, in terms of like providing educational programs, I think I was telling you this earlier, I've been thinking, what I need to be is an educational consultant, because every single person who lives here has very different educational needs. Some of them never learned how to read and write in Spanish, and so they come here, they don't know English, but they don't even recognize letters. So I would need one very different approach for them than I would for somebody who went to high school here but just didn't get enough credits and is no longer in high school, and they want their GED.
Right.
You know? And so, and then there's people who speak Spanish very well and read very well in Spanish, but they just don't know English.
Right.
And then for me, as they come in and they say, oh, Jennifer, you know, I'm interested, what can I do, you know, at your center? I go, well, I don't know, where shall we start? You know, in my first conversation with somebody, I say, well, let's have you take the TABE, the Test of Adult Basic Education. I mean, what a turnoff. They're like, oh, so you can tell me I'm stupid? No. You know, I don't want that. But yet, I need to know more about them in order to help them. And then send them to the place where they can get the best resources, and I don't even know what the resources are.
Right.
You know? I mean, there's another story that I really want the world to know. As I've been pursuing this GED problem, I contacted a woman that I know who works in another organization which is brand new. It's a private nonprofit, and they are supposed to, as an outside force, get into the public schools here and find out which kids have unmet needs and then find a way to get those needs met and help improve the system and build the system. But, you know, it's innovative, right? So I phoned her and I told her, my goodness, do you know the answer to this? I've got all these, you know, 16, 17, 18 year old kids wanting to do their GED. How is that possible? And I can't find any answers. Why is it I can't find any answers? Do you know? And she said to me that what she's finding in her year of being in this position, and, well, here's an anecdote that speaks volumes. She had a public school, middle school teacher come to her and say, I have this middle school student who should be in high school. How do I get that student into high school from the middle school? And she's going, wait a minute. You don't have anyone in the school system that you can talk to and get answers about that? You're coming to me? I've been in this for a year, and I'm not even part of the school system? How crazy is that? That a teacher is given so little information, there's so little system and infrastructure, that that's the best she can do? You know, and I'm not suggesting, and I don't think that person was suggesting either, that this teacher was inadequate. Mm-hmm. It's an indication of just how, like, there is no infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I really think there's, like, this colonized, you know, Wild West going on here in Syracuse, where there's no structures, there's no accountability, there's no mm-hmm. systematic mm-hmm. figuring out what people's needs are and bringing the resources to bear on those needs. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing it from my position mm-hmm. in this entrepreneurial project. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing that problem through this little peephole mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. going, oh my gosh, it is a nightmare out there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what can I possibly do? Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. I thought originally what I will do here is I will be a broker. I will mm-hmm. find out what the needs are, mm-hmm. and I will find the resources to bring to bear on the residents' mm-hmm. needs. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, there's no infrastructure in which to do that. Yeah, I certainly can't do it myself, and there's no resources to gain access to in a way that's accessible to these residents. I can't even send them a mailing. You know? You know, I mean, if I dedicate my few resources to designing a mailing that's appealing and, you know, mm-hmm. visual and whatever, mm-hmm. and gives the information that I need to give, and then I actually get it into people's houses, a small handful of those people will actually be able to read it. Mm-hmm. I don't know who those people are. Mm-hmm. And then will they read it even though they can? Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. they're going to be like, oh, they're on the phone talking to the school about discipline problems, mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, mm-hmm. whatever crisis is going on. Hmm. So I'm going, geez. You know, and I'm counting literacy enrollments and literacy completions, you know.
Goodness.
It's, you know, it is just huge. Yeah, and I love the idea mm-hmm. of having a case study. Mm-hmm. I have nothing, like, to hide. I have nothing to gain, really. I mean, I'm very fortunate in that I don't feel like my career is going to mm-hmm. be damaged mm-hmm. if people know what's going on here.
Right.
You know, I have nothing to lose by mm-hmm. having the whole world know mm-hmm. what's going on here. So I would be very interested mm-hmm. in documenting it and publicizing it in a way that mm-hmm. would be beneficial to the residents. Mm-hmm, that's, of mm-hmm. course, the big thing, is that whatever information I share with the world, I want it to be used for the benefit of the residents, mm-hmm. not against them. And I think mm-hmm. a lot of times, like in colonialism, mm-hmm. anything that the colonists found out about the colonized was used against them. Mm-hmm. It was used mm-hmm. to break them up. Mm-hmm. It was used to make them poor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, like having a case study or something and publicizing that would be great. Mm-hmm. I probably don't have time to do that myself. I would mm-hmm. love to have a student or a, mm-hmm. you know, a researcher do that for mm-hmm. me mm-hmm. and, you know, get it out there. Yeah. And I'm remembering this story about, my mom just told me this the other day. She, when she raised me as a single mom, and this was, they got divorced in the 70s. And the way they arranged the divorce agreement, only one parent could claim my sister and I mm-hmm. as dependents and as a tax credit. Okay. So they decided in the divorce agreements that my mom would have custody of us, but mm-hmm. my dad would get the tax thing, mm-hmm. whatever, fine. Mm-hmm. So when my mom did her taxes, my mom worked full time. Mm-hmm. When she did her taxes, she wanted to deduct the daycare expenses.
Right.
And it wouldn't let her do that. Because only the person who claims the kids as a deduction gets the child care credit. Uh-huh. She was like, well, wait a minute, that's crazy. I'm just going to claim it anyway and you know, see what happens. Sure enough, it was returned to her. And they said, no, you can't do that. So she took it to a neighbor who was a tax person, mm-hmm. and he ended up writing a case study about it, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. This is the way the law is, indeed, and it must be changed, mm-hmm. and eventually, like, a couple years later, it was changed. Mm-hmm. It was not in time for my mom to benefit, mm-hmm. but think of all, you know, I think of all the people, it was only because he publicized her situation that it changed, and it's funny, because I envisioned this mm-hmm. before I had that conversation with my mother, mm-hmm. but I really think, you know, if the information gets out to the right people, that's the only way that things are going to change. You know, and I can't do much except be eyes and voice. You know?
Yeah, and it also helps to know which way to have concluded yourself in the case study, what direction you should go. With that, it was clear that the law should change. What should you do here?
Yeah.
That's sort of a challenge.
Yeah, what should I do here? Yeah, and so the best thing I can hope to do is, you know, this, like, teachable moment kind of moving target, you know, kind of thing. Oh, how about your credit report? You know, great, they're here, they've got 15 minutes, we can do their credit report. We'll count that. They will benefit, and I can claim it, you know, as an impact.
Gosh.
And then I don't worry about it too much because I'm just one little person. You know, there's not much I can do. You know?
Well, this has been really, really, really interesting. I appreciate it. I do have to get going because I have some students coming.
All right.
But, yeah.